Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we continue a conversation we started in the last episode of Focus with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of Teaching with Authority, his brand new book available at shop.catholic.com if you're looking for it. And we're talking about the Nativity in the Bible and an entire episode on the genealogies last week.
Surprising. There's a lot of surprising stuff in there, wasn't there?
Amazing how much is it, just the genealogies, which I'm going to be honest with you, I bet a lot of people skip.
Yeah. And understandably, and you'd think a podcast about genealogies would be really boring.
Not at all.
But this one wasn't.
No, we had Bathsheba bathing outside in that.
Well, that wasn't the most interesting thing for me.
I'm just saying it wasn't boring.
Okay.
Father,
I was kind of more into the prophecy stuff.
I know. I'm sorry, Jimmy. I went the low road, but that's how we do it. You take the high road. I'll take the low road,
and somebody will end up in Scotland.
I can't remember who's going to get to Scotland first, but Father Hugh Barber mentioned to me that they were reading the genealogies when he was celebrating Mass, and the people started fussing about how long it was going on. The genealogy. John Chrysostom started his preaching with, God became man, I think he might have said, for your salvation. But in any case, God became man, and all you can worry about is there's too many names.
Well, they should count themselves lucky if they're only hearing Matthew's or Luke's genealogies, because if you start like First Chronicles, nine chapters is a genealogy.
Yeah, I have to say I skip them. I mean, they're just not – I mean, I don't know. If I review a book that has that starts with genealogies, I'm usually like, been there, done that. I probably shouldn't do that. I'll go to confession later.
You know, you miss some interesting stuff. I mean, if you skip that genealogy, you're going to miss Jabez.
Oh, right. And
remember the prayer of Jabez?
That his lands would increase
Something. Yeah. And it's like, okay, so Jabez, if you know your Bible, I mean, they made this huge publishing empire thing out of the prayer of Jabez.
Right.
And it's like, okay, number one, this prayer is nowhere near as spiritual as you're making it sound.
Right.
I mean, they're like the increase my lands bit, which is a land grab prayer.
Yeah.
You know, he's praying for his own prosperity. And they're making it sound like, oh, increase my opportunities to serve you, Lord. And it's like, no, that's not what Jabez is praying.
He just wants more land.
Yeah. But they made it sound like Jabez is the most important, figure in the Old Testament. And it's like, dude, he's mentioned in like one or two verses in an obscure part of a genealogy that nobody reads.
Yeah, right. But hey, if you can make a publishing empire out of it, God bless you. Some stuff in the infancy narratives.
Yeah.
It stands out because you wouldn't immediately think, well, that would go in an infancy narrative if I was making this up. And among them is the birth of John the Baptist, Elizabeth, Zechariah, the whole deal. It strikes me that being there, I don't know, but you can tell me, do you think that Mary later told these stories to people and that's part of how they got there?
Yeah.
But
and I think Luke makes that clear
when he says that he asked people.
No, he does mention in his prologue that that these things have been passed down to us from eyewitnesses and the ministers of the word, and he studied all these things carefully from the beginning. So he's been investigating eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. Eyewitnesses would be like Saint Peter, whom he met in Rome. Ministers of the word would be like Saint Paul, with whom he traveled to Rome.
Oh, yeah.
And then he mentions that many have written accounts previously. So he's been studying the previous written accounts. So that's where he gets all his data. But one of the eyewitnesses was Mary. Uh-huh. And he tells us twice in his infancy narrative that Mary remembered these things.
Oh, yeah.
And the only reason you bother, well, duh, she's his mom. Of course she would remember major events like this.
Right.
The reason to say that she remembered them is to tell us where he's getting his information. So this is the provenance or the chain by which Luke gets his information. It's coming from Mary. So either he interviewed her personally or he interviewed people that had talked to Mary. Mary is the primary originating tradent for this. A tradent is the person who passes on tradition.
Right. Okay. So if I were going to say create a mythology, I might – okay, I can see the virgin birth. I can see all these signs and wonders and all that. I don't throw in John the Baptist. Like that's striking me as so authentic because it's just – I mean, not that I believe that any of this is mythology. I do believe in the historicity of of the account.
But that's the argument you're making it's not mythology because John the Baptist is thrown in there.
Yeah, who would do that? Who would just throw John the Baptist and Elizabeth and Zechariah in there?
Well, so I'm not saying this is mythological either. One thing, though, that you have to bear in mind is that John the Baptist was much more famous in his time than he is in ours. Originally, John the Baptist was very famous,
right.
And then he knows, though, in the end, he's going to be eclipsed by Jesus. He says, okay. I mean, that's the one that's coming after me. He must increase, I must decrease. But the fact he says, I must decrease implies he's already really famous. And so he knows that one day Jesus is going to eclipse him. And in our day, that has happened. So people know Jesus much more than they know John the Baptist.
Okay.
But back then,
even in the 30s or 40s?
It was more – originally John the Baptist was the famous one and Jesus came later.
Yeah, okay.
No, later the same year. But originally John the Baptist was famous and he was so famous that he gets mentioned by the Jewish historian Josephus, who has a section on him.
Okay.
He also has a section on Jesus and one on James the Just, the so-called brother of Jesus. But like those are the three figures connected with Christianity that he mentions. So that it gives you an idea of how famous each of the three was.
Right.
John the Baptist had disciples apparently internationally. So it wasn't just that he had followers in Israel. I mean, he did have them there.
Right. I'm thinking about it in Acts of the Apostles.
Right, because Paul, when he visits, at one point he's visiting Ephesus.
Yeah.
And he meets these disciples who have received John's baptism but not Christian baptism. And so how do these guys over in Ephesus get John's baptism? I mean, this is, you know, 1,000 miles away. How did they get John's baptism way over there? And and actually, Acts seems to give us the answer because you look in the previous chapter, and while Paul is away from Ephesus, a guy named Apollos who shows up, and he seems to be from Egypt. There's a big Jewish community in Alexandria. We're told he was an eloquent man, but he only had an imperfect knowledge of Jesus. And so Luke says he preached accurately about Jesus, but didn't know everything, and he only knew the baptism of John. And so then two of Paul's associates, who are a pair from Rome named Priscilla and Aquila, who've been expelled by the Emperor Claudius when he gets rid of the Jewish leaders in Rome for a while, they come to Ephesus and they encounter Apollos and hear his preaching and realizes he's on the right track, but he doesn't know everything. So they take him home and give him a Bible study. And then Apollos goes off, and then Paul comes back and runs into these disciples who've only had the baptism of John. Well, who else only knew the baptism of John that was right there in Ephesus in the previous chapter and an evangelist?
Yeah.
It was Apollos.
Oh, so you have people evangelizing John's message out in the world.
1,000 miles away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So now
– And because John had said, I'm not the Messiah, there's the one coming after me.
Yeah.
Well, apparently Apollos knew that part of the message.
Yeah.
Because Luke says he taught about Jesus accurately but incompletely. So it's like he had John's message, including there's this one coming after me, but then he doesn't have the fulfillment in terms of now you need Christian baptism.
Okay, so I'm sure that he has Mary's recollections then, and there's but there's also an accounting for the benefit of the reader of this, of who this John the Baptist is, how he's related to Jesus.
Because he's the herald of the Messiah.
Yeah.
In a sense, the last of the Old Testament prophets, he gets to be the one to actually announce the coming of the Messiah in his own day. And so that's why Luke, among other reasons, thinks it's worth going in to all of this information about John the Baptist.
Right. Okay. I would just want to get to a little bit about who Mary and Joseph are then. Uh-huh. If we just go by what we have in the infancy narratives. Can we tell when we look at the infancy narratives of Jesus in Matthew and Luke's Gospels, was there still remaining suspicion about Mary even at that time? Are they trying to help her reputation?
At the time of the Gospels?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that continued for centuries because it's an obvious thing if you're not a Christian, you're opposed to Christianity,
right,
to mock the virgin birth.
Yeah, like, sure.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah,
And so you would have, there's pagans like Celsus, who was a critic of Christianity, would mock the virgin birth. But also non-Christian Jews would. So there is a book later on called the Toledot Jesu, or the Generation of Jesus, where it said that his father was really a Roman soldier named Pantera.
Oh.
And that's not in the Gospels at all, but it appears to be
Pantera.
Yeah. But it appears to be based on a misunderstanding of the word Parthenos.
Oh.
Or virgin.
Yes.
And so they've taken the word virgin in Greek and corrupted it into Pantera. So instead of being the son of the virgin, he's the son of the panther.
Okay. So so these are genuine recollections of that Mary has and she's shares.
Mm-hmm.
But they are placed there, at least you can surmise some of the motive for sharing, because not everything is shared clearly about Jesus.
Yeah.
So part of the motive of sharing these stories is making sure that it's understood who Mary is, what she's done, and that Jesus really is
the son of God.
Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the son of
God
virgin.
Because he's the son of a virgin. I mean,
otherwise,
that's pretty established.
Virgins don't have sons.
Yeah,
even Parthenogenesis doesn't give you a son. It would only give you daughters.
So the Parthenon is that because of
where the virgins, it's like Temple
Athena?
Of the virgins, of the virgin goddess, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, I got it. Okay, so then Joseph is the Joseph that we meet. We don't get an age for him. We don't get very much information at all about him. But we do know.
Especially not in Luke. Matthew gives us a little bit more.
Okay. So, but we do know that one part about he intended to divorce Mary.
That's Matthew.
Quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? Why?
Well, so there are a couple of theories. There's sort of the obvious theory, and then there's another theory that is entertained especially by very pious sentiment.
Okay.
The obvious theory is, Joseph— is engaged and thus legally married in their culture to Mary. And then before they've had a chance to start living together, so he knows he's not the father.
He's not the dad. Yeah.
She turns up pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And the normal inference from that would be she slept with someone else and has therefore violated her marriage pledge, and therefore it would be reasonable at this point to divorce her.
Mm-hmm.
But Matthew tells us he's a righteous man. So rather than exposing her to public shame, he wants to do it quietly. And so he doesn't want to humiliate her, but he thinks she's done something she shouldn't.
Right.
And so he wants to divorce her quietly. This is the theory that is kind of the obvious face value theory. It's also the one that Pope Benedict endorses in his Jesus of Nazareth books.
Okay.
He says Joseph assumes Mary's been unfaithful.
Right.
Then there's this other theory, which is much more pious but is harder to justify from the text. According to this theory, Joseph knows full well that Mary has not slept with somebody else, and that when he's told she is with child by the Holy Spirit, that's exactly what he believes. And so he thinks the Holy Spirit has claimed Mary for his own bride, therefore I need to divorce her.
Oh.
But if that's what he thought, Matthew could have communicated it a lot more clearly.
Yeah, because there's an obvious immediate impression.
Yeah.
Is that, and that, if he's going to divorce her quietly, mm-hmm. does that suggest there was an
option? Why does he need to divorce her quietly when if there's not something shameful here?
Yeah, does that mean that there was another option available to him? Like he could have raised a ruckus and like we know about women and adults.
Yeah, he could have had her stoned.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So he's protecting her either way.
Mm-hmm.
In the one hand, he's thinking, this is the Holy Spirit's bride. That's the mm-hmm. the very pious
mm-hmm.
idea. The other one is he doesn't want to harm her.
Right.
He's trying to protect her from harm, but mm-hmm.
But he also thinks she's been unfaithful and doesn't want to go forward at this point. Now, there's an interesting thing in the second century, just to jump out of the Bible for a second. There's a document known as the Infancy Gospel of James. It's also called the Proto-Evangelium of James. And according to it, Mary was a consecrated virgin who was only entrusted to Joseph because he was an elderly man that already had a family and wasn't looking to have children.
Yeah, okay.
So he would be an appropriate guardian for a consecrated virgin.
Yeah.
And you might say, well, okay, so if he wasn't planning on having children with her, why would he divorce her if she had been unfaithful? Well, if she was a consecrated virgin, that's why. She's broken her vow of virginity.
Yeah.
And he's not serving as the guardian of a consecrated virgin anymore if she's no longer a virgin.
No, he's fostering somebody else's child now. Okay.
And it'd be like indulging this person who's in fact sleeping around and having children. Well, okay, then this isn't the deal I signed on for. I'm not guarding this super holy person.
Right. Fair enough. Okay. The last person then I want to ask you about, and we saved him for last because he's the best, is the baby
Herod?
Jesus. No, Herod. He's not the best.
You have an interesting perspective there, Si.
No. Okay. So the child Jesus then.
Yeah.
Okay. He's fully God and fully man. Here's what I want to get. So there's people come to visit him, the wise men or the
Magi
at some point.
In Matthew and the shepherds in Luke.
Okay. And the shepherds would likely have come first. Am I correct about that? Is that
yes. Luke tells us the shepherds there were there the same night, whereas yeah. Matthew tells us that the wise men were there up to 2 years later.
So within some time yeah. period they
so
came.
All of those Christmas cards that show them showing up together lied to you.
Oh my goodness. I got to go fix my creche at home.
Yeah,
I gotta...
yeah you got to wait 2 years before you get to put out the wise men.
Well, I'm putting out the wise men now for 2 years ago Christmas.
Okay.
For Christmas.
There you go.
But what I did they would okay so the angels and the everything this has got to blow the minds of the shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
Now they come to see the baby Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Did they see anything unusual? Do you see what I'm saying? Or would they have
not,
just seen a baby and a mom and a dad?
They would have seen a baby, a mom and a dad, and Mary has already wrapped the baby in swaddling clothes, which was the standard for the time. They'd like wrap them up like a little mummy so that they're warm and snug right. and can't thrash around.
Yeah. But they still swaddle babies.
Yeah.
But I don't think
in different parts of the world.
Swaddling clothes. I don't know
well,
about that.
Well, swaddling, it's from swaddling cloths.
Oh, I see. Okay, so the
it was like a papoose.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, mm-hmm. so they show up, the shepherds, and they shepherds would have been young men probably, or who could it have been?
Well, we're not really told. We're just told they're shepherds, so they're going to be lower class, yeah. but rich enough, or not rich, that's not the right word, well off enough to have flocks.
Okay.
And given that this is night and it may even be cold, probably not the head of the household. So yeah, younger men is not unreasonable. They may have been hired hands.
Uh huh. So they get they come to see the baby Jesus. They see a normal. What they see is
yeah. We're not told they saw anything unusual. I mean, maybe he was like glowing or something, but we're not told that.
Yeah, it's not impossible. But what I want to get at is the baby Jesus is a normal baby. He's not like talking and saying, hello, I'm the Messiah and that kind of thing.
Not in this text, not in Luke, no. But you do have unusual stories later on, but they're fiction.
I got you.
Jesus grew up as, I mean, he was precocious in some way.
Sure.
He was even supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Really?
Yeah, and if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious.
I'll be very loud next time I say it.
But he, and his precociousness is demonstrated, for example, in the next account that Luke gives us in Luke 2, the finding at the temple, where he's already intelligently discussing Jewish law with the folks at the temple. But he was as Luke says, someone who grew in stature and wisdom and favor with God and man. So he did have a developmental process. It was a little different than everybody else's, but it was a developmental process. He wasn't like talking right out of the womb, according to the evidence we have in the New Testament.
So the shepherds then came because they were told that they would see. I can't remember. Were they told they would see the Messiah, or did they?
So the angels show up and they announce that I forget if they use the word Christ in the hymn that is presented there, but they understood this is a great sign, and so they wanted to go see it.
Okay, and do you imagine that was something that was remembered as well?
I'm sure. I'm sure they remembered it. Yeah. But it also Mary remembered them showing up the same night. So think of it, because that's the ultimate source of Luke's narrative here.
Right.
Think about Mary, and you've just given birth, and then these shepherds show up and say, "Hi, some angels just appeared to us, and we wanted to check it out. Is it okay if we come in and see the baby?"
Yeah.
You just gave birth to like an hour ago?
Right. Well,
I mean, these are the most unusual hospital visitors.
I know. How strange, huh? Okay. So then the wise men then, or the magi, here's my question about them.
Okay.
Why do they care about Israel? I mean, why do they care about what's going on all the way in that? They're from where? Persia? India?
Well, there's some debates. Now, the Magi historically were a class of Persian priests, the term came to be used somewhat more broadly. And so there are debates about, are they Nabataeans? Are they from the equivalent of not what we would think of as Arabia, but what was considered Arabia in the ancient world? Are they from Babylon? Mm-hmm. Are they – some people have said, well, maybe Babylon because Daniel was there, and maybe Daniel left – special knowledge.
Oh, because he's very Messiah.
He has
prophet.
Right.
Centered prophet. Yeah.
And but the evidence would suggest Persia. But in terms of why they would care, because of diplomacy, because of diplomatic relations, countries related to each other in the ancient world, just like they do today. And so there would be like diplomatic visits. Mm-hmm. That you would pay to show respect for people in neighboring countries. Now, all we're told is they were from a country in the East. We don't know exactly where. But they, by studying signs in the heavens that God had planted there, they discerned that a new king of the Jews had been born. So this is an important event in the life of Israel, and you would then – to foster good relations with Israel, which at the moment is governed by Herod the Great.
Who's kind of tough on Persians, isn't he?
He's kind of a jerk in general.
Yeah.
But,
I guess so.
But thus, exactly the kind of person you would want to foster good relations with.
Oh.
Because he's an important power in the local area backed by Roman authority.
Oh, yes.
And the Romans like him and have, you know, expanded his domains and things like that. They were the ones who put him in power.
Right.
And so so you want good relations with your neighbors. You just learned your neighbors just had a baby.
Yeah,
you want to go congratulate him. And so they mounted an expedition to come over, and they're not being guided by the star. Matthew never says they were guided by the star. He says at one point the star was in front of them, and it's kind of like a divine coincidence.
Okay.
But he never says they were following it. That's another greeting card thing. But they mount an expedition. They come over to Israel, or Judea specifically, and they go to the obvious place where you would find the new Jewish baby kinglet. the palace in Jerusalem.
And what? He's not there.
And he's not here. And what do you mean you've come to honor the king of the Jews? That's kind of me if I'm Herod the Great.
Yeah. And I've killed my sons.
And I've already killed more than one son and one of my wives. Yeah. And I'm paranoid and old at this point, and I don't want any new competitors.
So that's kind of a fail as a diplomatic mission.
So anyway, he then consults, says, well, where is it going to be? It's going to be Bethlehem. So they start to head out to Bethlehem, which is just south of Jerusalem.
Yep.
It's like 6 miles south of Jerusalem. And so it's night. They go out of the palace. They're heading south, and they see the star in front of them in the sky. And it's when they get to Bethlehem, they see it standing over the place where Jesus is. So it's like they look up above the house, and there's the star in the sky above the house. But it doesn't say they were following it. It just says it was there, and this is obviously a divine coincidence as part of God's providence.
Right.
But it's not like the star was leading them around as their, you know, GPS map light in the sky thing.
Indeed. Jimmy, I think that's about all the time we have to discuss the infancy narratives. We just barely cracked it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what's
there. We didn't
there.
Even get into why they're so eerily similar and different.
All right. Real quick, Jimmy. Now I have to know. Come on.
So in Luke's genealogy, now I have this theory. It's not – I can't claim to prove it, but I have a theory that Matthew was written second after Luke.
Oh.
And then Mark was written first. But that Matthew was written after Luke. And so Luke, on this theory, he comes along. He writes – he interviews Mary. He writes his narrative. It's got John the Baptist. It's got his father Zechariah and Elizabeth, his mom. And then it's got all this stuff about the Virgin Mary and her and what she's thinking and what she's remembering. And it's got this genealogy with Jesus coming from the line of Nathan. And if you're Matthew and you and he's got shepherds coming, these lower class guys, lower class guys coming up.
Right.
On the night of his birth to honor the new king. And you're Matthew and you think, is this the best set of traditions to help my audience of Jewish Christians appreciate the royal regal nature of the Messiah?
Yeah, right.
Or is there another set of accurate traditions about Jesus that I might want to select different than those, like, say, maybe ones that focus on Joseph instead of just Mary, and maybe ones that show Jesus's relationship with the current king, Herod, and maybe ones that show the foreign dignitaries, not just the local grubby shepherds visiting, and maybe a genealogy right up front, first thing of all in the gospel, that shows he's descended from the kingly line through Solomon.
Yeah.
And so we have all these parallels where Matthew and Luke go in different directions, but they keep paralleling each other. Mm-hmm. And on my hypothesis, the reason is because Matthew, while he acknowledges everything Luke says is true, he wants to reach a different audience. And so he uses a different selection of traditions to say, hey, wait, it wasn't just the shepherds. It was the foreign dignitaries.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the line of Nathan. It was the line of Solomon and so forth.
Fantastic. Yeah. So again, I think a lot of times people look at any difference and they go, well, this is not the same story. But the truth is, in reality,
they're complementing each other.
Even in family stories, there's like, well, that this person tells the story and selects these details, which are true as far as they remember. And this person selects these details for different – maybe they want to make themselves look better. But
we even have a saying for that.
What's that called?
There's two sides to every story.
And in the case of the infancy narratives, there are exactly two sides.
Yeah.
Luke's and Matthew. And both tell – I think it would be fair to say the greatest story ever told.
Oh, at least the prequel.
Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Thanks.
My pleasure. And Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for joining us again on Focus this week. And if you'd like to share Focus with other folks, let them know about the webpage Catholic Answers Live, where they can sign up for Radio Club, and they'll know when brand new Focus episodes come out each week. We'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Focus.